Hi, everybody. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Brian Edlow. He is the Vice Chair of Research at Mass General Brigham Department of Neurology and an Associate Professor of Neurology at Harvard Medical School. And I am very excited to talk to Brian today because his research centers around consciousness and disorders of consciousness and what we can do to help patients that are comatose or experiencing abnormalities in their levels of consciousness. So welcome, Brian. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Jen. Wonderful to be here. It's an honor to be joining you.
Thanks. So I just want to start off asking, in the most basic sense, what is consciousness? I know we're not going to be talking about metaphysical approaches to consciousness, which, although interesting, is out of the scope of what we're discussing. But when we talk about consciousness as it pertains to your research, what are we really talking about?
Thank you for the opportunity to dive into this. As you mentioned, there are philosophical components to this debate, neuroscientific, clinical, but let's focus on the clinical. At the bedside, how do we assess consciousness from a practical perspective? We look for signs of wakefulness and awareness, the two fundamental components of consciousness. From the standpoint of wakefulness, we're typically looking for eye opening. Does the patient do so spontaneously or to stimulation, whether it's verbal or noxious? And with respect to awareness, does that patient give us any indication based on their behavior that they are aware of themselves or the environment? Typically, as you know well, this involves following a command, whether it's giving a thumbs up, wiggling the toes. But the fundamental insight that has led to new conceptualizations of consciousness in our field is that there is a substantial proportion of individuals who are physically unable to express themselves at the bedside. They are unresponsive on our behavioral exams, yet they retain the ability to volitionally control their brain activity, to show purposeful brain activity as detected by task-based functional MRI or task-based EEG, giving rise to this notion of covert consciousness. Consciousness that cannot be detected on the bedside behavioral exam.
Oh, interesting. I mean, the converse point with the eye-opening part, I'm glad you're focusing on the awareness. But, you know, certainly we see people with eyes open coma, particularly the cardiac arrest folks. Their eyes are open, but they're not looking around. They're not doing much. Or the alternative of eye-opening apraxia patients who are actually aware but can't open their eyes. Sometimes locked-in people can't open their eyes either. So just eye opening alone is a limitation in and of itself. And then you have the covert consciousness as well. I actually wasn't aware that the eye opening coma was contentious. I thought that was common knowledge until I spoke to some of the rehab people who are like, no, you can't have acute eyes open coma, but it certainly is a thing.
As you're suggesting, it's an area of debate and your points are very well taken that wakefulness and awareness can be dissociated. And, you know, we can debate the terminology. Should we be using the term vegetative state or unresponsive wakefulness syndrome or eyes open coma? Not sure we want to go down that rabbit hole, but the most important point to highlight here is that awareness can be dissociated from wakefulness in some situations.
And so, Brian, are you going to talk about covert consciousness in the acute setting and the post-acute setting or across the spectrum?
So I'd like to cover it across the spectrum, and maybe I'll start with the historical arc. How have we gotten here? What are the advances that are most promising for improving patient care today in 2026, and where do we need to go in the future? So this field in large part started in 2006, a case report published in Science, as you know, not every day that happens, by Adrian Owen's group in the UK, where a young woman in the chronic setting, months out after a severe traumatic brain injury, is completely unresponsive under bedside exam, meeting behavioral criteria for the vegetative state. And yet, during functional MRI, when she is asked to imagine performing tasks, like imagine walking through the rooms of your house or imagine playing tennis, she shows a pattern of brain activation similar to what would be seen for you and me doing fMRI, giving rise to this notion that somebody who is not behaviorally responsive can show evidence of purposeful brain activity. Most of the research over the next decade and a half then focused on the chronic population months to years out from their injury. But as these tools, task-based fMRI and EEG, are now moving into the ICU, the same findings are being replicated. And the incidence of this phenomenon, according to the most recently published study in the New England Journal, a paper led by Nico Schiff, Yelena Bodine, and colleagues, showing the 25% of individuals who cannot follow a command at the bedside test positive for signs of purposeful brain activity with task-based fMRI or EEG. That finding pertained to the entire temporal spectrum of recovery, acute, subacute, and chronic. And so this is a phenomenon that is being seen at all stages of recovery, from the ICU to rehabilitation facilities to long-term care facilities. And it raises profound ethical questions about how we interact with these patients as clinicians, how we counsel their families, how we think about resource allocation, because most hospitals in the world don't have access to these advanced neurotechnologies. And happy to go down any of those paths that you think would be interesting for us to discuss.
So when you're talking about the 25%, can you remind me, were most of those patients TBI patients, cardiac arrest patients, and does the covert consciousness occur more commonly in one of those types of initial disease processes that leads to this apparent comatose state?
So it's a great question. And that study and others have shown that covert consciousness can be observed in individuals with all different types of brain injuries, whether it's traumatic or non-traumatic. In general, it tends to be more commonly seen in individuals with traumatic brain injury. It may be more commonly seen in younger patients as well. But there's a critically important point that I'd like to highlight here. And again, there's so many complexities to this discussion, one of which is, you know, what is that state like? What does it feel like to be a person who is diagnosed with covert consciousness? The short answer is we don't know. To my knowledge, there is no report of an individual who remembered that state well enough to explain what it was like. We can imagine that it might be a state of loneliness or despondency, but it's really hard to know what an individual experiences. Aside from the diagnosis, though, and what it feels like in that moment, there are critically important findings, mostly coming out of Columbia, a group led by Jan Klassen, that has shown prognostic relevance for the presence of covert consciousness when it is detected in the ICU. And I bring this up because to your question about etiology, those studies in Columbia included traumatic and non-traumatic patients, all age groups, and they found that if a patient is covertly conscious in the ICU, they are more than four times as likely to be functionally independent 1 year later. So however we think about what that individual's experience might be in that moment, there appears to be, or there's emerging evidence, that that is a prognostically relevant finding when it's identified early on.
Oh, interesting. And so in the ICU timeframe, that's critical, right? Because that's the time we make goals of care decisions frequently. And so it's concerning that, you know, we may not appreciate, you know, a substantial proportion of patients that may have a good recovery in the ICU setting. That raises a lot of questions that I kind of want to get into in terms of what we should be doing and how we can diagnose covert consciousness in the real world setting, not just inside of a clinical trial or at a higher level institution that has access to fMRI for ICU patients, et cetera. So what are you sort of suggesting in terms of what the average neurointensivist or practitioner who takes care of these patients, what should we all be doing to try to diagnose covert consciousness right now?
So many important aspects of that question. And I'll start with the theme of humility and acknowledging uncertainty. You know, certainly there are cases where there's a catastrophic brain injury, and based on currently available diagnostic tests, we as clinicians can use our informed judgment to share with the family that a meaningful neurologic recovery, however it's defined by that individual, is highly unlikely. And so I want to start by acknowledging that, you know, there are those cases where we can be confident in our assessments. That being said, there are many patients who have beaten the odds. And, you know, I say this as somebody who's been in this field now for two decades, have tried to read every paper and educate myself, and I'm still wrong frequently when it comes to predicting long-term recovery. And so my approach now when meeting with families in the ICU is to begin and end every family meeting with a message of humility and an acknowledgement that prognostication in the ICU is an uncertain art and science. And if you look at the implications of how we communicate with families, over 70% of patients with traumatic brain injury die in the ICU based on the withdrawal of life-sustaining therapy. not because their injuries were too severe for us to treat, not because we couldn't save their lives, but because that patient had their goals of care changed to comfort-focused care, and they passed away peacefully in the ICU. And for some patients, that might be absolutely appropriate. Perhaps they verbally communicated to their loved ones that even the best case scenario would be a quality of life they would not accept. Maybe they had written advanced directives that indicated that. Or there's some patients where the best case scenario for recovery might be an acceptable quality of life, but they've told their loved ones, I would never want to have a tracheostomy and a feeding tube, or I would never want to go through months of dependency that would be needed to get to that best case scenario. So I'm not suggesting that transition to comfort-focused care is always inappropriate. There's certainly cases where it is an appropriate course of action that is respectful of an individual's dignity and autonomy. But if you think about the burden of mortality, that the percent of cases of all deaths from TBI in the ICU that are attributable to withdrawal of life-sustaining therapy, and you look at some of the statistical modeling studies, hard to know for sure what these individuals would have recovered to because they weren't given a chance to do so. But statistical modeling studies suggest that about a third of them would have recovered to some degree of independence 1 year later. Now, those studies are imperfect. They're based on models, but nevertheless, they give us reason for humility when discussing prognostication with families. I'll pause there. I know I didn't get to what should we be doing in terms of technologies yet, but I just want to start with that message of communication, because the manner in which we communicate with families has been shown in multiple studies to be a primary determinant of their decisions about whether to continue or withdraw life-sustaining therapy.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with the self-fulfilling prophecy concept there. I'm just curious, there's an art, you mentioned art and science of prognostication, and I'm wondering how much more science should we be using in terms of, AI prognostic modeling? And, there's a lot of data that's on the table that we're not able to model ourselves per se, although many people would say intuition is natural AI. But there might be a science that would help us do better at prognostication, as opposed to post hoc statistical modeling that would say there's some probability of recovery, et cetera. Are we going to be looking at a completely different landscape a few years down the line when we're able to really build AI models that take into account the medical record, the imaging, et cetera, and try to put together a better estimate of prognosis for these types of patients?
Short answer, yes, absolutely. And just to speak for a moment about the technologies themselves and then about the models that are going to be generated from those technologies. So first principles, there are well-established guidelines. I look to the Neurocritical Care Society that's published guidelines on prognostication, as you know well, that can guide us as far as what tests we should be selecting, whether it's CT, MRI, SSEPs, blood-based biomarkers, et cetera. And when we think about how deep we want to go in these prognostic investigations, there's an elegant study by Benjamin Rohat and colleagues in Nature Medicine recently showing that the more tests we perform, the more multimodal of an approach we take, the more accurate our prognoses get, which I think kind of intuitively makes sense, but that team showed it in a very elegant way. And, do we start to incorporate these advanced neurotechnologies that we mentioned a moment ago, task-based fMRI, task-based EEG, or resting state fMRI? It's important to acknowledge that they are not available at many institutions. If they are available, these tests are now endorsed in the United States, the 2018 guideline, in Europe, the 2020 guideline. So these are not solely tests that are being performed in the investigational domain anymore. There are a handful of institutions in the US and internationally that do offer them. And one of the things that many of us have been brainstorming and trying to put together an initial kind of team of collaborators in service of these patients and their families is the idea of a hub and spoke model. For those institutions that can process and analyze the data, could they serve as hubs? And then community hospitals or other institutions that don't have necessarily access to the expertise to analyze the data, but could acquire it. And I'd like to highlight the point here that acquiring advanced EEG and fMRI data is far more straightforward than processing and analyzing it. So could these spokes acquire the data and then send them to the hubs for processing and analysis, similar to what many of us do with blood or CSF or urine samples, sending it out to, you know, expert institutions? That might be one model to disseminate or democratize these technologies nationwide and worldwide. But whatever we have available to us in this moment, to harken back to your point about the models, you know, we've been applying straightforward statistics, whether it's logistic linear regressions, for many years. But with the advent of advanced AI modeling, the field seems to be on the on the verge of a huge breakthrough here, where yes, our intuition will continue to matter, but if you look at these massive data sets that are being generated, I'll point to Dr. Eric Rosenthal, who's running the Chorus Bridge to AI, bringing together collaborators throughout our community to generate big enough data sets that would inform AI-based models that may be more accurate than us as human beings. There's a lot of reason to be excited about that new direction as well, regardless of which technologies are going into the model. So these AI-based models may be able to substantially improve the accuracy of our prognostication, whether or not we have access to task-based fMRI or EEG.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting to compare models that have the task-based EEG and fMRI data added to them or not, or ablation type of models, to see, you know, how much they really do contribute. And then we could, you know, get a better handle on cost and if they should be available at more places. The fMRI that you say is relatively easy to acquire, I'm assuming you're meaning more than just resting state fMRI. You're talking about task-based. Is that correct?
Right. Resting state certainly is more straightforward because no additional equipment is required. With the task-based fMRI, you do need earphones or headphones and an audio system. But I'll point to EEG here because it's safer, it's cheaper, it's more feasible. And let's say there was somebody at a community hospital this afternoon who wanted to perform this test for one of their patients. They could reach out and we could literally text them the MP3 file that we use to imagine opening and closing your hand and stop imagining it. They could walk up to that patient's bedside with their smartphone, play it off their smartphone to that patient's ear. And as long as they indicated on the EEG when they started playing that stimulus, that's all you need to do to acquire the data. So, you know, of course you want to optimize noise reduction and there are ways to improve the signal to noise ratio. But for the most part, that's how it's done. You either play it on a device with a speaker or you put earphones in the ears and you indicate on the EEG when the paradigm started. The challenge and where the expertise comes in is the processing and analysis. So that's why many of us are pointing to this hub and spoke model as a viable way forward for the field.
And of course, you'd have to figure out how to transfer the data with PHI and all these other things. But yeah, that is a great way to kind of democratize what we're talking about here, because EEG having much wider availability than fMRI, particularly for critically ill patients, might be the easiest one to start off with, just in my general opinion. But so tell me a little bit, though, about what are the limitations of these technologies, right? Of course, you want them as standardized as possible, et cetera, but considering the, access to them, generalizability of the results, et cetera, what do you see as the major limitations of using these or implementing these on a wider scale?
Like any prognostic tests we use in the ICU, these advanced neurotechnologies have fundamental limitations, the most important of which, in my opinion, is a high false negative rate. So if four listeners to this podcast right now were to all do task-based fMRI or EEG today, one of the four would have a negative result. So about a 25%...
meaning abnormal result.
Right.
Knowing negative, that they're not conscious.
Exactly. So a healthy 20, about 25% of healthy conscious volunteers will not show a response, will not show evidence of volitional brain activity during one of these tests. Now, there's some emerging evidence that we can get that false negative rate down. If you look at motor action, meaning the command is open and close your hand, as opposed to motor imagery, imagine opening and closing your hand, the false negative rate may be lower for action because it's kind of easier to try to do something even if you're paralyzed, it's easier to try to do something than to imagine doing it. But there are a lot of reasons why these tests can be negative, even in a conscious volunteer. Either we're not paying attention, or we're not trying hard enough, or we fall asleep during the scan or the EEG. And for patients, they may be on, even if they're not on high doses of sedation, when we typically just wouldn't perform the test, if somebody's on a low dose of sedation because of pain or bronchospasm on an endotracheal tube, you know, that could confound their results. So when we sit down to talk with families, and in the research domain, we've had permission from our IRB since 2012 to share these results with families if they want to know the results. And 100% of the families have asked for the results. Not a single one has said, I don't want to know. And we always counsel them that a negative result is essentially to be ignored because of that high false negative rate. A positive result, on the other hand, is more likely to be clinically meaningful. Now, with no definitive gold standard for consciousness, this goes back to your original existential question. How do we ever quantify the false positive rate? That is a very interesting and complicated question. One of the leaders in this field, Dr. David Fisher, University of Pennsylvania, is trying to tackle this right now with a group of collaborators. But it's a very challenging question to answer. So our counseling, based on current evidence to families, is that a positive result is more likely to be real and clinically meaningful. A negative result, because of the high false negative rate, is probably should just be ignored.
So when you see a positive response on fMRI, what do you say? How does that translate into functional outcomes when you're talking to families?
So that question, the answer is it depends on the chronicity and the manner in which those conversations take place, at least in my experience, is fundamentally different in the chronic setting versus the acute setting. So just to kind of paint the picture, in the chronic setting, if an individual is months or years into a vegetative or minimally conscious state, if they are found to be covertly conscious, there's some evidence that their chances of ongoing functional recovery are slightly higher, but the gains that they make tend to be smaller. The potential for recovery at that point is smaller. So there may be some prognostic relevance, but the functional improvements are limited. And for that reason, those conversations are much more challenging. And, you know, having been involved in these types of discussions many times, my experience has been that first family members will often say, wow, this is amazing. My loved one is conscious. They hear me, you know, there's a connection there. But then very quickly, sometimes within 30 or 60 seconds, you'll see this change in that family member's frame of reference, where they will become much sadder and say something like, oh my God, I can't believe my loved one is conscious. What must it be like to be in their shoes? You know, are they suffering? Are they lonely? It's, you know, it's a very different discussion because we don't know what that person's experience is like. On the other hand, in the ICU, because of the prognostic relevance and the 4 times greater odds of functional independence at 1 year, that news of a covert consciousness diagnosis is typically much more welcomed, because even if we're not sure what the experience is like for that individual in the moment in the ICU, there is this kind of hopeful aspect of the conversation where their chances of recovery are substantially greater.
So if you find a positive response to imagining tennis or something like that, do you go on to add additional tasks to get a better sense of how cognitively aware they are? And how does, if they pass multiple tasks, does that have a different implication for outcome? Like, is there a dose response effect that, you know, the more they can do on fMRI, the better chance of being functionally independent or anything like that?
It's a great question. And I wish the answer were yes. And certainly this is where our field is heading, developing brain-computer interface technology, whether it's non-invasive or invasive, intracortical devices. But at the present time, whether it's with fMRI or with EEG, because of how logistically challenging these studies can be to organize and arrange, although I did point out with EEG, it's much more feasible, so it can be repeated. And if you look at the studies out of Columbia, they will sometimes do it multiple times, upwards of 3 or 4 times for a patient in the ICU. But my understanding of their protocol is they're still repeating the same test multiple times, just to give themselves the highest chance of detecting a sign of consciousness, because these patients, as you know well, can have fluctuations in their level of vigilance. I'm not aware of any groups that are going through different tasks in a kind of escalated manner to detect higher and higher levels of cognition. There are a couple of notable exceptions, papers by Lorena Nacy and Adrian Owen, looking at kind of a stepwise type of language processing. There's some work out of Canada, also looking at differential levels of language processing, but those are essentially all in one scanning acquisition, like one, you know, hour scan and a single EEG acquisition. The kind of tantalizing possibility that we could use these techniques to communicate, there are, to my knowledge, I believe two case reports. One is from Martin Monti's work published in New England Journal of Medicine back in 2010 or so. And the other is from that Nacy paper that I mentioned, where different fMRI paradigms were used to allow an individual to link yes or no responses to different imagery tasks. But that is incredibly difficult to perform logistically, and it requires a lot of sustained attention and working memory on the part of the patient. And so it just hasn't really been a tractable approach for most of our patients.
Has there been any work doing EEG at the same time as fMRI, just to see how they can complement each other, or if the relationship?
There is some brilliant work happening at the Martino Center right now at MGH, just to make a plug for one of our colleagues, Dr. Laura Lewis at MIT. Her lab has been developing exactly what you mentioned, a state-of-the-art MRI at 7 Tesla with EEG, with high-density EEG cap. So it is possible to do, and the insights that are coming out of that lab are groundbreaking and really showing us new relationships between fMRI signal and electrophysiologic signals. But doing that on a standard 3 Tesla or 1.5 Tesla scanner in our hospitals, I'm not aware of anybody pulling that off. Our group looked into it a couple of years ago, and it just wasn't logistically feasible to pull off. If anybody's done that, I would be really excited to hear about it. But to my knowledge, it's only been done thus far in healthy volunteers and at specialty research facilities.